And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Monday edition. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman has the day off. We visit today with Boston College Professor of Sociology Charles Derber. He's the co-author of The Surplus American, How the 1% is Making Us Redundant. And he joins us from Newton, Massachusetts. Welcome to you, Charles Derber.
Hi, Joseph. Thanks for having me.
So define a surplus American. What does that mean?
Somebody who is not finding a place, a viable job, is the most obvious candidate for surplus. But one of the ideas of the book is that there's the unemployed and the underemployed, who constitute close to 25 million people officially, are really stand-ins for a much larger group of people in the country, maybe up to as many as, there are 308 million people in the United States. Maybe 100 million would fall into the category of surplus, as we define it in this book. And we mean by that, beyond the officially unemployed and underemployed, there are many people who have been kind of forced out of the labor force or sort of seduced out of the labor force. For example, many people, I know this as a professor, go back into school because they can't find a job. So in a sense, a certain percentage of people in school are there because jobs are simply not available and they don't know what to do with themselves if they're not. So school provides a sense of having a place, but it's a little bit illusory in some sense. Military or prisons, for example, which is a huge growth industry, actually, you know, people in prison are not counting as unemployed, but those are people in age ranges and education ranges where unemployment is very high. So. And then there are all kinds of make work in both the private and public sectors. The book kind of outlines a variety of kinds of people who are really marginalized from any real prospects of finding a meaningful job or even a sort of meaningful role in the larger society. And I guess what makes it worse, I'll just say one more thing, if I might, is that the argument that we're making is that this is not simply a process of the sort of laissez-faire operation of the market. It's a deliberate strategy by economic and political elites who recognize that profit can be maximized by reducing reliance on the American workforce. And it's been accompanied not only by sending jobs over broad or displacing people technologically with robots and all kinds of other new technology, but disinvesting in the fundamental infrastructure. I mean, the infrastructure in this country, I mean the physical infrastructure, roads, highways, the environmental infrastructure, the social infrastructure, healthcare and education and so forth, there's been a systematic disinvestment to the point that the ability to reconstruct that infrastructure is a daunting, if at all possible, task.
The 1% is in the title of the book you co-authored, Charles Derber. It's very easy to gang up on the 1% and blame all the economic woes on them. What about, some would say, what about personal responsibility? And if people work hard enough, they will succeed.
Well, that is the dominant view of, I think, how many people see the problem. Certainly, you know, mainstream neoclassical economists, so-called free market economists, have confirmed that argument because they argue that, you know, supply and demand naturally, even in the labor market, make involuntary unemployment impossible. In other words, the market will come to equilibrium at the point where the prices where, you know, workers will work at a certain wage and jobs will be supplied at that wage. And so if you get long-term unemployment, you're dealing with essentially workers who don't want to work and are either lazy or shirking jobs or looking for a handout. They're, you know, the so-called 40% of takers that Mitt Romney referred to. But in reality, the jobs simply aren't there. And education itself doesn't ensure them. And part of the reason that we wrote this book is to counter the myth that you described. That is that... now, let me make one other caveat on this. There is certainly an enormous need for productive work, particularly in the area of reconstructing the energy infrastructure of the country, because the environmental issues are so profound and so linked to the future competitiveness of the economy. I'm not trying to argue here that there's no rational argument for expanding jobs or no possibility of doing so. I'm simply arguing that the way that our economic system and our political system operates is that the people in charge have concluded that they can do better by essentially disinvesting in the country and in the American labor force.
As of now, as we speak, the national unemployment rate is about 7.8%. How accurate are the unemployment figures of the government? Do they ignore people who are just too frustrated to even look for work anymore?
They do. I mean, this is just factually very simple to explain. If you're a discouraged worker who has been looking for work and then has dropped out because you think you can't find it, you're not counted as unemployed. And there's something, we don't know exactly how many people there are, but there's something between 2 and 3 million discouraged workers. There are also workers, sort of cousins of the discouraged worker, who are not officially counted as unemployed, who are very underemployed, meaning they want more work because they're not making enough hours and wages to support themselves or their families. Those people are also on the edge, and I think of them as part of the surplus population because they're marginalized to the economy. They have a marginal attachment to the economy and their jobs. So the official numbers understate the actual levels of jobless or people who don't have access to the amount of work that they need by a very significant amount. And remember that by talking about the surplus people in the country, I'm talking about a variety of types of people who don't fall under even a much better metric of unemployment, but simply people who, I mean, for example, I mentioned students who can't find work. There's the issue of retirement. Now, many people, of course, want to be retired and choose to be retired earlier if they can afford it. But mandatory retirement is another way of putting people who may want and need to work out of the labor force. There are a variety of categories of people like that who we don't think of as unemployed, but who fall into this category of surplus people. And I guess the broadest way to think about it is simply people for whom jobs and meaningful roles are not really any longer available in the society. So the society has to find some way to, pacify the dissent that naturally arises from that and to absorb. We talk about surplus absorption institutions, which could be prisons or it could be the military. You see historically these patterns, for example, after war, at the end of World War I and World War II, when millions of soldiers came back to the country, the question was, were there jobs for them? Because the military had absorbed so many people. And remember, prior to World War II, even with large stimulus from the New Deal that FDR was pouring into the economy, there were just millions and millions of unemployed and surplus people, and it took World War II to absorb these people. And when the war ended, there was a big dip in unemployment and the question of how would you put these people back to work. And there wasn't an immediate answer, and so there was a, you know, an education program for vets, obviously, and a very crucial thing was that women who had been brought into the labor force during the war were sucked out of it by a kind of new definition of you know, women's role in society, which was to be full-time housewives in these new growing suburbs of the 50s. And the family itself, in a sense, became a surplus absorption center, because had women, and this is, of course, what Betty Friedan wrote about in that famous book that started feminist thinking in a new wave, if women had wanted to find fulfillment in work, the culture and the economy had changed in ways that said that your proper place is at home. And that was a partial solution to the surplus crisis that the end of the war produced. In after World War One, there was a significant spike in unemployment because the soldiers all came home. And the solution to that was to introduce the little plastic card that we carry around, credit, so that people who didn't have jobs could still consume. So this is not a new problem, Joseph. That is this problem of the surplus population. But we argue in the book that it's become much larger and more severe as globalization has permitted outsourcing of millions of other jobs, as new types of technological change have reduced the prospects for jobs, and most of all, as the political culture has changed and the time scale of business elites and the way they're thinking are changed, and where short-term profits and political strategies have basically facilitated this sort of corporate trend toward outsourcing and technological displacement and production. Really, what we're no longer a manufacturing economy. What we're manufacturing is a huge number of people who are viewed as not necessary or redundant.
Charles Derber, we need to take a short break. We're talking to Charles Derber. He's a Boston College professor of sociology and the co-author of The Surplus American. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Monday afternoon, and we resume our conversation with Professor Charles Derber. He's the co-author of The Surplus American, How the 1% is Making Us Redundant. If you'd like to phone in with a comment or question, you're certainly welcome. That number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email is open. radio@wlrn.org, if you'd like to make a comment or ask a question, or perhaps you have a story to tell. Charles Derber, you say in the book the jobless are just the tip of the iceberg. So what's beneath the surface?
Well, part of it is what we've been talking about, that there are so many millions of people in this country who don't feel or really cannot find a meaningful job, which goes beyond the officially counted unemployed in the country. There are officially, as you said, the national unemployment rate is about 7.8% right now, and that leads to, you know, maybe 14 million people or so. When you count in the discouraged workers we talk about and the underemployed, you get up to close to 25 million. Then you start adding the tip of what's under that particular iceberg is all of these other categories of people that I touched on earlier, you know, whether it's housewives who really want to be in the workforce or retired people who are forced out or young people who really are staying in school only because they can't find a job. There's an interesting program up in the NPR station here in Boston, which is WBUR, which you might know about, Joseph, which is called The Stuck Generation. And it's about young people who, you know, go to school, then they come back and live at home, can't start a family because they, and this is basically a program which comes out of NPR and documents the lives of people in this, you know, sort of who are in their, basically in their 20s or early 30s, who just can't sort of start adulthood because they are essentially surplus people. They don't use that term. At least I haven't heard it, but
and to the parents, really what it's about. And to the parents' chagrin sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, this, of course, is not a problem restricted to the United States. It's very, I remember watching a French film in which it was a hilarious comedy in which the parents are desperate to get their grown kids out of the household, and unemployment, surplus crisis issues in Europe right now, given the crisis of the Eurozone, are even more intense. You know, you get up to 40 to 50% of young people who simply can't find work. So it's in a global economy, it's a global problem, since it's always useful to employers to be able to push down the cost of labor, and one way to do that is to move jobs around and to keep a lot of people out of jobs, because it means that people are willing to work for lower, you know, anything that's, I mean,
And even work two part-time jobs but still get no benefits.
Or that's right. Or more, and jobs are being reconfigured that way so that more and more work is contingent, meaning that employers don't have to pay benefits. They don't have to sort of hire with the expectations of long-term, sort of like a one-night stand, the temping phenomenon, and all the varieties of that in contract work and freelance work and so forth, this generation has come to take for granted. But it's transferred an enormous amount of risk, and from the employer to the individual, which makes one wonder more about the myth that you mentioned, that people are having trouble simply because they're lazy or they're not willing to work. I mean, the reality is that Americans work longer. The Americans who can get work are working longer, partly because the corporations prefer to keep existing employees, shrink the size of the core employee base of the group, and then basically that allows them to work people who are very afraid of losing their job longer, and they'll do so without complaining because they'd rather have the job, seeing all their friends who don't have jobs. So the corporate system has evolved ways to keep people working who have jobs, working longer at less pay. I mean, as we know, this whole process of the higher the surplus, the lower the wages of the people working, because their bargaining power is decreased. And in a way, globalization, I mean, there is the technological revolution. You know, we've had prior technological revolutions. They've often increased employment because they brought in people into the factory. The current wave of technology, there's a lot of discussion about this among economists, but there's, I say, a growing consensus that there's something different about this wave of technology involving robotics and so forth that is more job displacing than it is job creating. And then in regard to globalization, which has gone on for a long time, the British, when they globalized, basically insourced labor. For example, when they took over India as a colony, India had a flourishing textile industry. Instead of outsourcing work to that industry, they basically shut down the textile factories in India and insourced that to build up the industrial infrastructure and employment inside Britain itself. So we've sort of shifted from a globalization that insourced to a globalization that is, even though there's some insourcing going on, is primarily outsourcing.
Let's take a telephone call or two. We're speaking with sociologist Charles Derber of Boston College. He's the co-author of The Surplus American, How the 1% is making us redundant. Before we take our first call, Charles, how about a website where people can learn more about you and your numerous books?
Well, my if you just Google me, you'll find a Wikipedia entry, you'll find my website information and my Boston College identification, and you can go to Amazon to get information about my books.
And that's D-E-R-B-E-R.
It's D-E-R-B-E-R.
And let's take a caller. This is Anne. She's in Fort Lauderdale. Hi there.
Hi. I would like to bring up the unfortunate group of workers, the older worker who are not quite ready for retired age, but unfortunately had lost their jobs due to outsourcing or whatever. For instance, I have a spouse with a higher education, a degree in higher education, a doctorate degree, who is having great challenges in getting new employment from his program being outsourced. And the challenge is, it seems like the longer your resume these days, that doesn't look particularly attractive to employers. And then if you've been out of the job market for 6 months to a year, some recruiters don't even want to look at your resume. So the answer for highly qualified older workers, and I understand that is one of the groups that is having the biggest challenge in getting new employment. And that's my question.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, because I've been sort of highlighting the dilemma of the so-called stuck generation, young people. But you're absolutely right that on the other side of the lifespan, people in their 50s and 60s are often being laid off because they may be paid more than people who can take their work in India or China or some younger workers and so forth. And their prospects, given the cutback on pension systems and the relatively low payouts of Social Security and so forth, people can't easily retire. Most, the average level of savings in the country is very low. And, if you're retiring it with $20,000 in the bank or something, you can't live easily. So you have to try to find work. And the other thing that you mentioned, and I'm sorry to hear about your spouse, but it's a very common story, so I'm glad you shared it with us, is that it sort of punctures that myth, which is that people, the problem is that people are not getting, education, not willing to go back to school, get retrained, or get high levels of education. Your spouse, I think you said, had a doctorate. And in the book, we go into this in some detail, because when you look at China and India, for example, you have hundreds of millions of extremely well-educated, scientific, technical, information age sort of people who are willing to work at one quarter or less of what the wage that your spouse would probably get paid. And so there's, the sort of the idea that both conservatives and liberals tend to promote is that education protects you. And statistically, it's true that highly educated people have much lower unemployment rates than higher education people. But the prospects, I see this at Boston College, of my students, many of whom don't know what they're going to be doing, are not able to find jobs. Having an MBA, advanced degrees, is no guarantee in this surplus system at all. And I agree with you that for people in the in their 50s and 60s, for example, it's a crisis, because on the one hand, their income streams, the saving levels and the social programs that will support them are going to be cut under this, what's going to be the big drama of probably Obama's second term, which is how much of the New Deal social welfare program is going to be slashed away, which has enormous implications for people nearing retirement. And on the other hand, the sort of tendency to want to get rid of older workers who cost too much, is that from the point of view of the employer, when they can make more money by redistributing that work or eliminating it, it's just an enormous crisis. And you know, the problem is that the Democrats are not thinking about this issue with the kind of magnitude of scale of change and resources that are going to be required to deal with it. I mean, it's a little bit like, I mean, people have been disappointed, in other words, on the day of the inauguration, and, you know, Obama has done important things, but it was interesting. He talked about climate change, but, you know, the scale of response on environmental issues has been pathetic, really. I mean, given the nature of the catastrophe that we're facing, in the range of dealing with the crisis of the workforce, including older workers and young workers, because so much corporate money has gone into politics and shapes both parties, Obama is doing, you know, far less than is necessary to solve this problem. And this is fundamentally and systemically irrational, as I was trying to say earlier, because the ironic truth is we desperately need people employed, many people of all skill levels in all ages, simply to reconstruct the infrastructure of the country. I mean, particularly around energy needs, but and the environment. But I'm talking about the social infrastructure around deteriorating education schools. And yes,
Charles Derber, we have to take a short break, and we'll return with more from you. Charles Derber is the co-author of The Surplus American. Let's take that break, and we'll be back with more. And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. We continue with Charles Derber of Boston College. We're talking about the book he's the co-author of called The Surplus American, How the 1% is Making Us Redundant. Charles Derber, compare today's economic woes to those of the Great Depression. I suppose things could get much worse.
Yes. We're not. Well, as you know, people like Keynesian economists like Paul Krugman argue we are in a Great Depression. The problem of counting that you may have official numbers of unemployment and so forth make it hard to make these comparisons. But I think it's very possible that given the, you know, the sort of constraints, political constraints, and the sort of construction of debt into this sort of actually, it's funny, during the Obama administration, and this happened to some degree in the Clinton administration as well, the notion that the underlying crisis was not a crisis in jobs, not a crisis of surplus people, but it was a crisis of spending too much on the surplus people, has been taken by both parties. It was actually in the inaugural address that I heard Obama give. He said that he was intending to focus very centrally from the economic front on the issue of debt. That is a kind of signal that this problem is going to worsen, because to deal with debt means major cutbacks in the programs that would directly stimulate employment. I mean, one of the arguments that I make in the book, and it's an argument that Franklin Roosevelt during the Depression took seriously, was that you do need direct creation of jobs by the government at all levels, from the federal government down to the community and the states. Roosevelt did that from 1933 to 1936, got unemployment down. Conservatives, not unlike those today, ganged up on him right about this time in, you know, at the beginning of his second term, and forced him to cut back substantially in public investment and the economy went rapidly into a second major decline in 1937 and stayed there until basically the World War II. So if you use that as your historical benchmark, it's not at all implausible that the political dynamics will lead to significant cutbacks in spending. I mean, Obama himself is talking about reducing the deficit by $4 trillion, which is going to involve cuts in entitlement programs, but also, more importantly, in infrastructure investment, public investment of all kinds. And that is almost certainly going to make the economy worse, because it will take massive investment to solve these problems.
I have an emailer here. This is Sharon. She says, with so many people out of work and have a lack of hope, is there any chance of civil unrest?
Well, in the book, when I was writing the book, Occupy Wall Street movement was bursting onto the scene, and the issues of extreme inequality of a 1% or less of the population that was concentrating enormous wealth and power and sending a lot of jobs away was an indication that at some point, I mean, as in the Depression, there's a point at which the problem is recognized as a system problem as against a problem of individual bad luck or individual laziness or whatever. That, I mean, the elites are heavily invested, and you see this particularly among Republicans, and it was part of, Mitt Romney's campaign, that the 47% are simply lazy. They're takers. They don't want to work, and they just want to be coddled and become permanent wards of the state. There's sort of dual narratives going on. The kind of narrative that I'm trying to advance here is that the problem is less people not wanting to work. I think Americans are hard workers. They work longer and harder, actually, than in any country in the world. And the problem is systemic and structural, which is that we have a system and an elite that finds it more profitable for themselves to remove jobs and disinvest in the infrastructure that would permit future jobs to grow here. So I think there's going to be dissent. I mean, the thing Occupy has fragmented. It never developed it focused on the issue of extreme inequality and the kind of surplus status of a growing percentage of the 99%.
It never seemed to be as pulled together, say, as the Tea Party movement.
Right. And it avoided electoral, strategies out of a sense of hopelessness that either party would really address the issues it was raising. And I think that was a mistake. I think there should have been more focus on electoral politics, as well as, of course, education of the population, which was its main. It didn't fail because it raised these issues of the 1%, the 99%, and extreme inequality and the surplus status of a growing number of Americans. So I think it did. I think these terms like the 1% are going to be with us for a while, and that's helped alter the conversation. But I think dissent will grow. I mean, what has to be overcome is the idea that it's takers. It's that 47% of lazy people and more who are really responsible for their own fate. They're unworthy people who don't really want to work. And I think, that argument can work as long as unemployment and surplus, crises remain relatively modest. But when you see lots and lots of people getting thrown out of their homes and foreclosed and losing jobs on Friday afternoon with that pink slip, and people of all ages, like the caller who talked about her spouse with a doctorate who was closer to retirement but had been laid off, and the stuck generation that NPR is running its programs on, you get enough evidence that this is happening everywhere that you realize that this is not something that you can just blame on some bad apples or some lazy people, that this is really a systemic issue, and it's been essentially designed by people who are in a position to do so, and it can only be solved by the people who are, you know, being marginalized and victimized coming together and in some way operating. And in the past, that's always happened, and I'm quite confident it will be happening as well now.
We're speaking with Charles Derber. He's the co-author of The Surplus American, How the 1% is Making Us Redundant. Let's take another short break. We'll be back with more. And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you. Bonnie Berman has the day off. It is today's Topical Currents. We're speaking with Charles Derber of Boston College. He's a professor of sociology, and he's also the co-author of The Surplus American, How the 1% is Making Us Redundant. If you want to learn more about him, you can Google Charles Derber. That's D-E-R-B-E-R. Let's take another phone call. This listener, this is Ed. He's in Miami. Hey, Ed.
Yeah, hey, I've only been listening for about 10 minutes, so maybe you talked about this. But, well, first of all, you know, I hear you talk about the 1%. You do realize as a Boston University or Boston College professor, you must make over $100,000. You are the 1% when you look at the world stage. So I don't know if you're part of the problem. But and one way you're able to sustain that income, you know, of all the industries that deal with information, I would say the universities have the cost of delivering that information has not gone down. The university system is in for a rude awakening. I don't know when it's going to happen, but you know, your model is your data numbered. You said this is different than the old days. You know, I'm not so sure. I think it's just happening faster. If you read the history of technology, the steam engine, it took them 60 years to double the output, the horsepower output, 18 months is Moore's Law. And you talk about inequality. The only thing I'll say, you keep talking about corporate investment. The only point I'll make is for every dollar you take out of the private sector to give to Solyndra or any of these other favored, you know, whatever it is you want to invest it in, you've taken a dollar. It might be the next Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs started Apple with $1,000. And the problem with the free enterprise is you never know who the winners are. And that's the dilemma you're in. Are you going to give it to a government bureaucrat or give it to somebody who's got skin in the game?
Well, you've put in a lot there. I wish we had more time to talk about this. I'll just make a couple of responses. One is the free enterprise system is not a free enterprise system. It's a heavily statist system already. And I mean that in a sense that you might not recognize. Corporations suck off hundreds of millions of dollars each year in corporate welfare, and they couldn't really, including many entrepreneurs, couldn't get going. This argument took place during the campaign, of course, about, you know, did I build it myself? And Obama tried to make the argument, I think not all that successfully, because he was pilloried for it. But the truth is that entrepreneurs, certainly large corporations, cannot function. For example, you raised the educational system. The educational system is a form. Imagine if the corporations had to spend the money themselves to educate all of their workers. They, of course, do spend a lot of money on education. But if they had to make their employees completely literate, and they had to spend money to build the roads, and they had to do all of the things that governments do that allow private industry to function, they wouldn't survive. They couldn't compete, essentially. So I mean, I think there's some mythology about the whole idea of the free market. Go ahead. Did you want to?
I just want to respond. But they do. Where do you think the money comes to build the roads, to educate? It's tax dollars. It comes from the private economy. They don't, unless you're printing money or borrowing money from the Chinese in a true free enterprise system, you're not doing that. You're not creating money out of thin air, inflating the currency. And so that money comes from taxpayers. They do pay for that. They do build that.
Oh, yes. The taxpayers pay. I agree. But it's not just, I mean, people like Mitt Romney, we knew, and many of the largest, as I'm sure you know, many of the largest corporations every year, the Fortune 500, pay no taxes. It's amazing, in fact, how many of the largest corporations, because they have helped shape the tax laws and because they have tax havens and they have the kind of carried interest in private equity firms that became an issue in the campaign for Mitt Romney and so forth. So, of course, yeah, the government, I think you're agreeing, the government is spending a lot of money that facilitates the profitable operation of companies, but that money is coming from taxpayers, as you say. So you're essentially socializing, in a sense, the costs of production. That is what I mean by that is that people around the country, as you say, are subsidizing or paying for that, but you're privatizing the benefits, meaning that, and this is why you get these, this is documented by these huge inequality data, which show that of all the growth over the last 25 years, the average wage has remained, in real terms, has remained stagnant. The average wage is around $31,000, and the top, the top strata of the society has increased their wealth many, many, many fold.
Well, but so but most investors had a tough time the last 4 years.
Yeah, but if you look at the actual concentration of wealth and the wealth of the, let's say, the top 1% of the 1%, the very, very wealthiest Americans. I do a little exercise in my classes where I have people stand in a line, and if they're poor, they start at the same level, and then you look at what's happened to their income and their wealth over 25 years. And, you know, the people who represent the top income, they have to leave the room. They have to walk out of the room visually because their wealth has grown so high. Now, that's been moderated a little bit since the crisis, because you're right, with people with a lot of money in the markets took a hit, but the basic trend has not changed.
Again, we're speaking with Charles Durber, Boston College professor of sociology, and we're talking about his book that he's co-author of, The Surplus America and How the 1% is Making Us Redundant. David in North Miami Beach emails and says that my guest's surplus labor matches the 23% tracked by the website Shadow Stats. That includes the 7.8% unemployed that we talked about and 14.4% and underemployed.
Right. And I would encourage people who really are interested in this to take a look at the book, because I am trying to sort of expand the imagination and to reflect the realities of much beyond these 23 to 25 million people that your emailer is referring to. I think there is a much larger group of people in the country who are essentially facing a surplus status, even though they don't necessarily feel it because they're in school or they're in the military or whatever. But I think the unemployment data, even when calculated in a more accurate way to include underemployment, so forth, do not remotely reach the total sector of the population. It's sort of like the poverty data, Joseph, which the official poverty level is around 12-14 million people. 12-14%, which is about 40 million people. When you look at the way real poverty operates, you're closer to 100 million people near poverty and so forth. So, I think the official data are very misleading about this.
Well, I certainly want to thank you. It's been a great pleasure. Once again, Charles Durber, for those who want to find out more about your numerous books, a website where people can learn more.
Yes. Well, the website is long, so you won't remember it. But if you just Google my name or go to Boston College and the sociology department, people can find. And you're right, I've written a lot of books which all converge around the many important themes that you've been asking me about, Joseph. So, and also people can email me at durber@bc.edu. I'm always happy to field conversations and questions.
Well, we've about run out of time. I want to thank you, Boston College Professor of Sociology, Charles Durber. His book is called The Surplus American. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me, Joseph.
And thanks for listening. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our program is produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from Paul Leary, And you can follow us on the Topical Currents Facebook page for discussion, photos, and links to books and authors. Also, free audio archives and digital downloads of past programs at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow's program is with neuroscientist Dr. Sandra Bond Chapman. She's the founder and director of the University of Texas Center for Brain Health. She says we all have the ability to increase or decrease our brain power, despite age. Now the calendar. On this day in 1793, 220 years ago, the execution of French King Louis XVI in Paris by guillotine. Gulp. And on this day in 1924, 89 years ago, the birth of actor Telly Aristotle Savalas in Garden City, New York. His first big film was Birdman of Alcatraz. Coochie Coo, baby. We're all born bald. One more while we face a double bogey. On this day, 1940, 73 years ago, the birth of golf legend Jack Nicklaus in Columbus, Ohio. He won 80 PGA victories. The Golden Bear. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And so we leave with the last words of Louis XVI before facing the big blade. Quote, I die innocent of all the crimes laid to my charge. I pardon those who have occasioned my death. And I pray to God that the blood you shed may never be visited on France. This is Joseph Cooper. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for Neil Conan and the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.